Hello, and welcome to The Squeal, PIC's swine management podcast featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Disease elimination is our topic today, and as one of our guests notes, becoming ever more important as the industry works to reduce antibiotic use. Today's disease elimination specialists include Dr. Bill Hollis of Carthage Veterinary Service, PIC's Dr. Jer Geiger, and Dr. Jean-Paul Cano. Truly a world-class group of swine health professionals.
I'm Dr. Bill Hollis from Carthage, Illinois. I'm a private practice veterinarian and also work with PIC on multiplication herds. Do have clients that have been through disease elimination programs and feel fortunate to be part of that.
Jer Geiger, I am a PIC employee for nearly 20 years. I have had the good fortune to serve pork producers large and small, multipliers and commercial herds domestically and around the world. PIC has offered me a lot of opportunities, and my focus has always been biosecurity and health, maintaining health. But there are times when we have disease opportunities when we can eliminate those diseases. And so I've had the experience of eliminating a variety of diseases in a variety of scenarios, and happy to share that. The beauty of this industry is that we share our successes as well as our failures for the benefit of the people that we work with.
I'm Jean-Paul Cano. I'm a veterinarian from Venezuela. When I went to vet school down there, and then I practiced for 4 years about that. And then I came to Minnesota to do a PhD with Carlos Pijuan and Scott D. And then I worked a little bit as a practitioner in South America again, and then a bit with Boehringer for about 3-4 years, and then I've been with PIC for 4 years. So I'm in charge of the health team for the Americas, for North and Latin America. So I get the opportunity to interact with a fantastic team of PIC veterinarians and independent veterinarians that collaborate with us, and we get put in situations and, you know, very often to consider elimination in our own farms or in customer farms. So it's very, very interesting experience.
Disease elimination. What's the top of your list? What are the top two or three, man? What's under your Christmas tree when it comes to disease elimination? Which bugs?
For me and my clients, it's whatever is the most punishing at the present time. So, yeah, so I would say historically it's been PRRS, and there's been a lot of talk about PRRS virus. I came to practice in 1996, and we've been talking about it for 22 years. And so it started with PRRS, I would say, for me, just because of timing and the impact. We are evolving those projects and actually quite predictably moving those projects to other diseases. PED would be another quick pain, get rid of it type virus. But then now talking mycoplasma, talking even influenza possibly.
Mm-hmm. For a breeding stock company is probably more black and white, right? So the expectation of the customers, especially in North America, but growing around the world, has been that they want both boars or semen or gills that are free of PRRS virus, and of course the coronaviruses, so PED, Delta coronavirus, and TGE. Mycoplasma is becoming more a standard of, it has to be mycoplasma high and pneumonia negative. Of course, Brachyspira, high dysentery, Actinobacillus pleuropneumoniae. And now, as we're talking here, influenza. People appreciate having negative yields for, you know, to raise them as replacement animals. So those are diseases that we don't think too much about. If we get an infection, we try to go and eliminate as soon as possible.
So connecting those two, I would say echo and support what both gentlemen have said, and that is, you know, at the commercial level, it's what's most painful at this point in time. Whether it's PED and suddenly I've got scouring pigs in the farrowing room and what am I going to do, or it's a more chronic situation. I've dealt with PRRS for 5, 10 years. Do I have to live with this forever? The beauty of some of these elimination strategies is that you can actually double these up and go through similar processes concurrently and eliminate more than one pathogen at a time. And that might be worth consideration, assuming that you can stay negative. So that always is your first question. Can you stay negative?
Well, and the go-forward opportunity today is because of both the diagnostics to validate that we're free,
yes,
and the gilts and bores or semen, the gilts to create that, the gilts to use for that repopulation and to validate that they are free. So we didn't have that option in the past, neither the diagnostics to know or the gilts to utilize, and both of those are available today.
So before we start these elimination processes, I usually advise, or when we're in the consideration phase, that I advise that we ask a couple of questions up front, and that is, one, can you stay negative? Are you in an environment where if you go PRRS negative, are your neighbors negative, or do you live in a very swine-dense area where you could have a successful elimination, but then the neighbor's finisher breaks and contaminates you? So can you stay negative? From a facilities and location point, that's one consideration. The second is, as Dr. Hollis has mentioned, do you have a source of negative animals? It may not be worthwhile to try and go influenza negative if you don't have a source of influenza negative. Semen doesn't count, but bores and gilts. Then the last one question that I think is worthy of consideration in the decision process is, do I have the right culture? Okay, do I have the right mentality? Do I have the right people with the right goals and expectations? Because this will take more discipline than perhaps they've had in the past. And if we up our game, do we have the participants, the co-workers, to keep out the pathogens at a higher level of biosecurity?
For me, I also believe even if a client chooses to remain stable positive, say for even PRRS or mycoplasma, having a naive gilt, predictably naive gilt that we know we can immunize, or in the case of mycoplasma, inoculate and immunize, we see a significant improvement in productivity in that female having a known product as opposed to pulling back and variability in that gilt development. So I think it does start with knowing where you're at and then identifying the goal clearly. And if the goal is disease elimination, the next step is figuring out all of the requirements to truly accomplish it. And that can be difficult in some systems, especially a system that's very tight in terms of flow and space. They may have to identify alternative space for a breeding project.
Yep.
Or carve out space specifically for a breeding project so they can utilize those animals in a safe location, flow those animals into a clean sow farm if they're truly going to eliminate. All of these strategies are talked about in the veterinary circles and the producer circles to the point now where I really believe we've got a predictable game plan and we have a repeatable successful game plan for many of our clients that is different for different diseases. So there may be, depending on the goal, there may be a change in that strategy.
And I think, Dr. Bill, you've touched a point that is very important, and let's use the mycoplasma example. So you get to visit systems or countries where, you know, some people say, well, I prefer a mycopositive source, so that way, you know, they come already infected, and then I have less of an impact when I introduce those replacement animals. But what we try to remind them is that a positive source not only put out positive animals, but also negative animals, and it's a little bit unpredictable, right? So you get batches of negative animals and batches of positive animals, and that really complicates the acclimatization process. So having a negative source gives you a high expectation of those animals, and it's very consistent, and then you manage when and how you want to immunize them. I think it's a plus.
Well, and what we're finding even in pig dense areas that we've chosen to stay positive stable for PRRS, we may still eliminate mycoplasma, stay positive stable, vaccinate, but we will eliminate mycoplasma because of the impact of these pile-on diseases in the growing and finishing pig. So if we do have a naive gilt source coming in, and we do have a game plan that allows us to load and close and off-site breed or provide the sufficient closure time period for an elimination plan for mycoplasma, we may do that knowing that we're not going to get rid of PRRS or intending to get rid of PRRS, but we do it because of the impact on the grow-finish pig. Your comment about an incoming positive source for mycoplasma makes me think of those clients that have this continual struggle mid and late finishing because of the activity that really starts in the farrowing crate. Mm-hmm. and they've not been able to push that out of their system.
So in your experience, when Jer outlined three different, well, pillars is the popular term today, but the three different areas that could be an issue when we discuss elimination, if we say the environment, the location, we set it aside and we've got culture and we've got diagnostic capability or ability to manage the health of that herd, which is the most frequent reason that an operation may elect to stay PRRS positive? Is it culture, or is it fear of rebreak, or is it a lack of ability to see the ROI? Why don't we all?
I might start the conversation by saying I think there are two components. One is the inability to maintain a negative status, which may be a function of location. But the other might be a concern over facility. Now, in the United States today, we have a tendency to think of at least two or three site or multi-site production where the sow herd is completely separate. If, for example, you have a farrow to finish operation, these disease elimination strategies, unless you're talking depop repop, these disease elimination strategies are much more difficult. And so you have to kind of think about what are my facilities, what is my flow, what am I capable of actually accomplishing, how does that fit into? Dr. Hollis mentioned the possibility of an off-site breeding project. That's, you know, I smile because if you've got the opportunity to do an off-site breeding project, that opens up a lot of opportunities. Additional costs, yes. To do that off-site breeding project, but your return on investment, your cash flow, all of a sudden gets accelerated very nicely. But not everybody has that facility and those resources. So that's two reasons why they may not elect to go with an elimination strategy is they can't stay negative or it would be much more challenging with my existing flow and facilities, okay? Which, when a sow farm, when a system expands, that might be an opportunity. Now I have additional facilities. Maybe I can make that part of my elimination process then.
I see. I see Central Iowa pig dense location concern for being a naive herd and breaking, as the explosion is so severe that they do not want to even risk it. And so in those situations, utilizing a modified live vaccine for PRRS in particular and staying consistently immunized greatly reduces the risk of a massive loss of piglets because of PRRS virus introduction. Even in those situations, however, we would strongly advocate a naive guilt to PRRS entering into a guilt development structure that immunizes that female. And if we do introduce a wild type virus or an outside virus, we would still utilize disease elimination strategies for that wild type virus on that farm. So piglet movement strategies that reduce the activity of virus in farrowing and closure to guilt entry so that we're not re-exposing activity to those young guilts that don't have that wild virus. So it really is unique to the individual, both in terms of location and in terms of their history. And then as an owner of those, that owner needs to decide what risk am I willing to tolerate? How far do I want to go to capture performance, and what risk would I have in pursuing it?
And that is a very hard decision, for sure. In some situations, you have extremes that is easy to decide, but that you have a lot of situations where it's not that easy to take that decision, right? So we have tools. We have, you know, risk assessments. We have the history of that farm. We have sequencing now to understand what has been the challenges to that specific farm. So I think we have to use them, because the most impactful mistakes or wrong decisions we can take would be, one is going full elimination and have a naive herd for a disease in a high risk zone. So then you have the situation Dr. Bill was mentioning. You have a clinical outbreak with a tremendous economic consequence to that farm. The other mistake would be having a situation where you have a very low risk, but you didn't decide to go for elimination, so you're paying a constant tax on your performance because you don't have that high health status that you could have in that location, right? So you're paying your outbreak in 3, 4, 5 years, but you're still paying. So those two extreme, you know, run decisions can hit the business if we don't help that decision to be accurate. So
I think sometimes we do have to call out the culture, even within our own organizations and to our clients. And if the culture is one of status quo and living with the disease is just because we always have lived with the disease, we need to call that out and then challenge the opportunity, challenge ourselves with the opportunity. Otherwise, we see no benefit, no opportunity. So. It's the open communication. I do think we're fortunate that the veterinary teams and the producers tend to be very open with their experiences, good and bad, and share. If we don't take a good look at ourselves on some of these, and I'm thinking of mycoplasma, look at it critically and evaluate the opportunity even in the face of other diseases. So.
And when we talk about return on investment and how quickly we can pay for the exercise and the investment of going through these. You want to recognize that, again, you may try for multiple diseases at the same time. You can do PED and PRRS at the same time. PED is just a good excuse to go ahead and get that started. But you don't necessarily have to stay negative forever. As Dr. Kano pointed out, you know, maybe if I could stay negative even for 3 years, if I could stay negative for 3 years, then I can pay for what it costs me, because PRRS is that expensive to me. Besides that, I already know with the loss of these pigs in my PED outbreak, all of a sudden I've got a gap in my production flow anyhow. Let's use that to our advantage. And it jumpstarts your processes and your thinking. So you don't have to stay negative forever for it to make you money.
You mentioned earlier the multi-site versus single site multi-flow on the same site, and in my mind that's a conversation of immunity versus elimination. Really, if they're single site, really, then you become the manager of the immunity. You can still get PED out of a single site farm. You can still get PERS even, although it would take a much greater effort. I'm not sure we would want to pursue influenza or right. mycoplasma without a depopulation, repopulation. But those return on investments are, those returns for that investment are also influenced by the population. So what do I have to get my hands around?
When you say influence, I wonder about other operations in the area. When somebody breaks, does everybody else say, oh, well, then heck with that. It didn't work for them, it won't work for us. How does that interaction with those owners happen when you have a break? Does that change things for them? Make your job harder to discuss elimination?
There are regional control programs. They initially started calling them regional elimination programs, and I think some people were reluctant to communicate and participate for fear of attempting to eliminate. So, I think those regional control programs are critical to the discussion. Both to notify neighbors and then to understand what's going on in the neighborhood. They also help us to discuss immunity. So if we're not going to eliminate, what tools are we using for immunity? How are we using them? Where are they effective? I'm thinking of the Faring House now. What do we do in the Faring House to minimize or even eliminate the organism in that particular population of pigs? So if your goal is to maintain stable with a high level of immunity, that may be the best thing you can do in your location. You talk to your neighbors about wild virus, you look for it, and if you're not finding it, you're working it out of your herd or out of your neighborhood. So those communications are critical. I do think there are tools now, both mapping tools, discussion boards, even Facebook pages for people to quickly post and share. So I think that's helped move the process along. Certainly helped those that were in pig dense areas that thought we could never get rid of mycoplasma. Now they're looking over their shoulder at neighbors who have successfully eliminated mycoplasma and said, that may be one that we can pull off in this area and successfully accomplish improvement in pig health. And the penalty for being wrong is not so bad. So if you have finishers that break with mycoplasma, or even a sow farm that is in a pig dense area, it can be severe, but also managed without significant loss.
Absolutely. I think the statement of, well, we have poor health status, so we don't have to really worry about biosecurity has almost disappeared from the industry, and that's a good thing, because there's always a chance for something else that'll be worse. Think about PED 2013, right? So you had PERS, you were in the middle of Iowa, well, biosecurity is not top mind. Well, you got PED, so you had another thing to worry about that you could have stopped, or you can have a new PERS strain, or you can have APP, or you can have something else that can make your production more difficult and reduce your profitability. So when you ask about, what happens when a farm has an outbreak, especially an impactful outbreak, I see that from a positive perspective. That is, there's no better opportunity for do a case investigation and a risk assessment than right after the outbreak to identify those holes or gaps in the system that you can improve, you should improve, and then to reassess, where you are at on a risk perspective to decide you know, the immunity management, what you need to be doing and all that. And there isn't a better time to transform the culture of biosecurity in a company, in a farm, that right after an outbreak. So I think that we, as professionals in this area, need to work with our clients and producers and farm staff to use those opportunities to change the reality that they had at that time.
Let's take the stake that Dr. Kano drove in and say, we've had that outbreak. It's time to get rid of it. Take me forward. Where do I start? How do I go through the process of, I've decided elimination's the way to go. Now what?
Well, I'd like to start that with saying, in today's industry, with our multi-site production systems, among the veterinarians, we often think automatically of the load, close, and standardized immunization across the sow population. We think of that. But I think in the context, if we're talking about disease elimination, there are other strategies to utilize. And I would emphasize, don't go straight to that and bypass, for example, a true depauperi pop, because that may be to your advantage. And there may be, again, you can, with a depauperi pop, you eliminate multiple diseases at the same time. Your time window may be relatively short, depending on how you do it, right? But look at all your different options and look at your facilities and work with your veterinarian. And take advantage of the experience of not only that veterinarian, but the practice and the industry, and then make an informed decision.
I think of your conversation earlier about multiple diseases. So I have a client with multiple sow farms that had a APP history. And so Depop is the only solution.
Right.
We've tried multiple different strategies that bug in particular is going to stay in the population and is going to shed during periods of poor health or other health challenge. It will show up. And so for APP, that client was able to minimize the impact of APP over those 9 sow farms as the first step. So that's medication and piglet movement strategies, things like this, but minimize the impact while at the same time validating they had a APP PERS mycoplasma free source. So their gilt multiplication was in another state and was very high health and was coming into that state to be immunized. You were asking, what do you do first? Well, it may be a multi-year plan. It's a big process. And they did not anticipate 100% success, but they anticipated some failures and carved it out over a number of years, picking which sow farms they were going to do first, doing some continued strategies to minimize the impact on those herds that they could with the load and close. And actually, they started bringing in gilts less frequently, but in larger numbers, so they increased their gilt development space. But in the end, the big answer was, we have to depop, repop these farms. And so it's just been this sequence over time.
Do you doctors think that we're doing just not enough depop, repops in the industry these days?
Well, I would say it's difficult because as you look at the industry, you've gotten larger and larger sow farms. The efficiency of a 5,000 sow farm is simple. You can look at the USDA reports and they say your highest production is on your biggest farms. And you can teach your teams to specialize and you can focus on your specific areas to become very, very good at day one care, and that's all that person does. Depopping and repopping a 5,000 sow farm would be a very difficult breeding project or a very expensive downtime.
And I agree with that, but also the not only the farms, but the systems have got better. So they are not only one farm, but there are many farms, so if all of them share the same disease that you're trying to eliminate, you know, let's calculate the impact of doing kind of coordinated rollover depopulations in the system to improve the overall health of that system in 3-5 years, right? So because If you calculate the impact of one closure, you're going to age the product distribution of that farm, you're going to reduce inventory, you're going to lose productivity because you're not going to have yields for a period of time. Well, that's a cost. So how is that compared to the cost of the depop, repop in a sequence event in a large system? So plus, what are the additional benefits that you can get with that, right? All the box, genetics, time, cost, of predictability and the performance. So I don't know, just a question.
Bill brought up a great example, and I smile because I think I would have liked to have been a part of that one with multiple sow farms and APP, which I have a history with APP, so that's one of my sore spots. But with multiple sow farms, you can, that's almost a luxury. That's a tool that you could really utilize. And I think of the possibility of, we talked about off-site breeding project, why not set up an off-site breeding project that your whole purpose for the next 5 years is to breed sows for a depop repop, and we do this one the next 4 months, and we do that one the next 4 months, and we do that one the next 4 months. That could be, at the risk of sounding insensitive, that could be fun, yeah, to actually pull that off. Or you could do a parity segregation thing that could really be useful. There's several things that you could utilize and put together in different, put the same puzzle pieces together in different forms and come up with a workable solution.
I think of the herd that Dr. Kano and I and Dr. Reek worked on that had multiple sow farms. And it was purely for mycoplasma, but that breeding project was 80 weeks. It was an 80-week breeding project, so in a series. And the interesting thing in that particular situation is because of the health and productivity of the rest of the farm, and really mycoplasma was the only evildoer that we were trying to get rid of, we were able to move those other sows, young parity primarily,
right,
to the other farms. Yeah. So we had no gilt entry in those other farms while that farm one was going empty, and then repopulate farm one, and then you're just moving the young parity sows out of farm two into farm three and out of farm three into farm four, and it really worked very well. And I think isolation, biosecurity, culture, those were all already present, which made it much easier to implement. It still was not easy. I shouldn't discount that. It's right. Very challenging on those teams that are breeding in a finisher barn and moving pregnant gilts, and it's very difficult. But in terms of flow, that was much more manageable.
That's a good example of using both methods. You've depopulated, repopulated two farms, and then use the repopulated sows to afford your hair closure with minimal impact on parity and inventory. So that's a good example on how to do it with limited impact.
I do think we mentioned culture earlier too, and ownership has to be firmly behind it and then support it every day, because it's somewhere in the middle. It's hard to see the end, and I think it becomes very trying on people and sanitation and biosecurity, and especially if it's a long process. I really believe that the ownership need to be both the firm supporter, but then also the cheerleader to keep the positive, the reasons why we're doing this.
So to get back to your question earlier, we've kind of talked about putting together a game plan and then structuring that game plan, building a roadmap, recognizing that there can be speed bumps and there can be deviations, but build a game plan, build a timeline, and then maybe I'm two or three steps down the road, but I'm saying start making assignments. You're responsible for this. You're responsible for this. You're going to be in charge of the gilt breeding project. Maybe I have one person who, in particular, is going to kind of look over all of our shoulders and make sure that we're doing things right in terms of biosecurity and what are we doing with transport and did we do that right. So at some point in time, once you've got the game plan, now get it down in writing so at least you have a template, recognizing there may be deviations, and then start making assignments on who's going to do what and what's the time expectation.
There are task management tools electronically today that people can go on to and assign names and even deadlines and then report back in and click and everybody sees when this one is accomplished. So many of these projects roll together, and so your two-thirds of the project are waiting on the completion of the first third before you can even start.
Right.
And so those tools are valuable to help the team understand where they're at in the process, and then, as you described, take ownership of their piece of that process.
Evaluating execution. It's a multi-stage program. There's a lot of pieces on that chessboard. How do you make sure that things are going? I mean, I love the idea of a task management system, but how do you make sure that we are moving forward at the right speed so that we all end up at that corner, that intersection, at the time we need to be there in order to move forward farther?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, my answer harkens back to some of the things that I think Jean-Paul mentioned early, and that was tools that we have, diagnostic tools that we have that 10, 20, 30 years ago, Bill, we didn't have. PCRs, oral fluids testing. You make sure that you have, in fact, achieved what you want to achieve, that this population is in fact negative and we're not bringing in positive animals. So there are some diagnostic tools. There are some sampling tools, oral fluids testing, environmental testing. And we think about at some point in time, it's where the rubber meets the road, and now we're going to put negative pigs into what was a positive facility. And so you do environmental samples to make sure that our sanitation is what we need it to be in order to make sure that we don't reinfect a negative population with a positive facility and a contaminated facility. So there are tools that we have today that we didn't always have that you can benchmark your progress. Does that really get to your question?
I also think you have to discuss which diagnostics are going to be the most appropriate for the answer you're trying to achieve. And so I'm thinking in mycoplasma in relation to antibodies and serum versus laryngeal swabbing looking, or tracheal swabbing looking for PCR, looking truly for the organism. And in a previously infected, stable, positive herd that goes through closure in order to introduce naive animals and eliminate mycoplasma without depopulating, there's a tremendous amount of diagnostics that you want to do before that point that you introduce those animals. Mm-hmm. And the diagnostics that you use have to be specific for the answer you're looking for. So you want to go looking for the organism, not the antibodies, because you've already created this high level of antibody. And at the same time, utilize the diagnostics in that naive population very close to the time you're loading the truck, because you don't want an additional period of doubt if you tested them 3 weeks ago, but you haven't tested them and you're getting ready to load them. Yeah. And move them in.
If you think about that, that's very interesting on, you know, the communication element of all this, because what you guys are describing, you can tell that there are kind of two levels of decisions, right? So big decisions. So you guys talk to your colleagues, to the farm manager, to the owner, to decide when you stop guilt introduction, when you resume guilt introduction, when you start a different process in the foreign room, when you do your immunization, how you do it, and all that. Those big decisions that need to happen, right? And at that level, you need to explain why and go through all that process to get everybody on the same page. We have a solid plan that we are going to execute. But then you move to the smaller decisions, right, where you have to go to the farm and talk to the people that are taking thousands of decisions on a daily basis that can change the outcome of that project. And then they don't need probably that much on the why exactly, on all the details and the science behind it, but they need the details on how to do it, very detailed and day by day, action by action, so nobody makes a mistake there. So in your experience, you've been involved in many, many projects, so at that small decision level, what are the main reasons for failure in projects? What do we miss sometimes that people don't execute to the expected level and we fail?
We call it in our system drift from protocol. So you get this excitement at the onset of the project and this interaction where the team is all going to work together. And in the case of PERS and say piglet movement, you have someone who really in their heart is trying to make the best decision for that piglet that isn't nursing well, but they start moving pigs. And not moving pigs around is critical to reducing the level of PERS and then eventually getting it off the farm. So when they drift, I actually think sometimes the person that's making that decision believes that they're doing the right thing, but they're drifting from protocol and leading to failure of the project. We saw the same thing with PED. We had PED projects that were very quick. The elimination went very predictably. The sanitation came in at the right time and created a safe, clean environment for the newborn pigs that were going to be free of PED and have good immunity from their mother. And then we had other projects that just drug on and drug on because they were unable to execute on either the sanitation or unable to execute on the piglet removal if they saw the diarrhea. And those projects failed until we established that strict protocol and adherence to the protocol.
Dr. Kano mentions the amount of information we give in the barn, at the barn level. They just need to know what they do. There's a need to give them the big picture, yes, so that they know that they are a part of this project, which is encompassing the entire operation.
It's always important to help people understand why they're doing what they're doing. If they understand why, sometimes they don't make those, they don't go through that drift because now they see what is the end goal. And if they understand why you don't foster pigs, they're less reluctant. They're less likely to do the fostering. So I think you can't just say don't foster pigs. You have to say, why are we not fostering pigs? What is our goal here? Well, we don't want the virus moving around the barn. Okay, so moving pigs moves the virus? Yes, that's where you need to get with this.
I've seen drift from gilt immunization protocols also, and I'm thinking of things like circovirus or mycoplasma, where the staff believe that there's this margin that if they work within the margin of a certain amount of weeks, we'll be fine, just though they're immunized. When in all reality, the date of that immunization was chosen for a specific reason, and they need immunized at that time period. And the trouble is you don't know that until later. And so you have to audit that process and do the diagnostics on the baby pigs produced at that farm to assure that the protocol that happened 4 or 5 months ago in the gilt development is still on protocol and is accomplishing what we want it to accomplish at some point later in the future.
And someone didn't stretch a vaccine.
Right, and we don't want them to stretch the vaccine or forget the vaccine and mark the page. Yeah.
So we reached the promised land. The herd's healthy. How do we keep them that way?
Well, Before, okay, before we reach the promised land, how do you know that you reached the promised land? I think that's an important question. How do you determine success or failure? And I'll speak, either one of these guys could tell you, I believe the strategies are fairly consistent regardless of the system. There's two different ways that you can establish a success or failure. One is you look at the production flow. If you have successfully eliminated the disease, and let's just use PRRS as an example, those piglets may have maternal antibodies, but eventually that flow should those maternal antibodies die out, and you can't ever find the virus on a PCR, either on blood or oral fluids, and so you've got tools that you can use to check the flow. The other arm of determination is the replacement animals that you put in. So if you have successfully eliminated PRRS from a sow herd, from the resident population, that means that when you put in negative replacement gilts, they don't develop immunity, they don't have antibodies, and they won't be PCR positive, again, on oral fluids or on serum. And so those animals that you put into the resident population then become what we call sentinels. In fact, you could use some negative animals to check your progress and see if the resident population was in fact negative. You could just put in a handful of them and give them 2 weeks and say, do they develop clinical signs? Do they go PCR positive? Are they developing immunity? If not, looks like maybe we've reached a certain milestone. The problem with both of those is that to be really confident, it takes time, because we could check in 2 or 3 weeks and see, but that may not give, in the face of a low prevalence of a disease, may not give it time to manifest itself, and maybe you didn't test enough animals or you didn't test the right animals. So it may take, in order for me to really feel confident that I have eliminated the disease, I like to be 3 or 4 or 5 months down the road. If I put negative sentinels in for 5 months and nobody ever got sick and I can't find any virus in there, then I feel like I'm ready to declare success. And likewise, if I can produce if I can get my pigs up to 5 months of age, unless I've contaminated them from the outside, you know, I think I've got a success when they in fact are negative. So, did I say that right, guys?
Yeah, I would agree with your monitoring options. There's more than one way to monitor. I would add that I believe that the team that is on the sow farm that goes through the elimination also needs feedback from the pigs that are leaving the farm and how they're performing. And that can be some of the most convincing is, here's where our performance was when we were active with PRRS, mycoplasma, and flu in the finisher, which is quite common in pig dense areas. And then here's where our performance is today. We deal with several different shareholder groups that may be even in different states, but 5 or 6 farmers that own in a farm together. And it's very valuable to get them in the room and to share their performance, because we can see changes and benefit and feed that information back to the sow farm manager and team, so they know when they're making a change that's positive, they see the outcome in the growing pig.
Absolutely. And as we discussed before on, you know, the planning and the ROI discussion, the impact of a failure of that elimination project makes a big difference for, you know, how intensive or how much money or how much time you need to take for that validation, right? So if you're talking about a commercial farm that needs to change the flow in their nurseries or winter finished barns, probably after three consecutive negative tests on a weekly test, you're okay with that. You change the flow, and you get feedback from your nursery guys, and that's enough. For a multiplier, you might need one, you know, you might want more information. You want more time, or put sentinels through the herd and test them and get more sample, you know, more samples from that population. So it depends on what could happen if you fail, that drives your decision and how much to spend in terms of time, resources, money, in that validation process.
One thing I want to add to the validation also is baby pig processing fluid as a diagnostic tool. So that's an evolution of monitoring that has really been helpful because it was behavior in the farrowing house that was creating some of the disease problems. And so we can use that collection of fluid at a time when we can still have an impact on those pigs for the next 2 or 3 weeks. And then we can do that very quickly and routinely without a lot of additional cost. So I'm excited to see definitely for PERS, the use of that as a tool. You mentioned 3 weeks in a row, and I'm thinking of the turn of the farrowing house. So if your farrowing house is going to take 4 weeks from an empty, clean farrowing house to be filled, farrow, lactate, and wean, and then fill again, you want to continue that process of monitoring the entire period so that you know that you've emptied that farrowing house, and then probably monthly from there to just make sure that you're maintaining it.
Excellent example of a technology or a knowledge mm-hmm. development that is helping us on the project, right, for processing fluid testing for PERS virus. In the past, to take the decision when to really enforce, intensify MacRebel, so reduction of movements in the foreign room, it was a little bit of an art. So you go by testing on your wean pigs, and you look at the pigs, and yeah, they look right, let's intensify, because you don't have infinite attention and focus on the foreign room staff to do that for 34 weeks, right? You can do that probably for 8 weeks or 10. Now, with this technology, you can say, now we're following negative piglets. So in the next 4, 8, 12 weeks, let's put all the energy here to kick the virus out of the farm. So that's a great technology that we can use to be more successful, more predictable in the outcome.
I'm going to invite you to ask a question of each other after this next question, but as far as maintaining the status now, keeping that up, give me some ideas, give me some suggestions. What are good procedures, protocols to maintain that status?
Well, we've discussed a lot about the culture and biosecurity culture for that farm, and you hope that you did everything right after the outbreak to elevate that culture and to consolidate that culture in the farm. If you think about biosecurity, one component is your policy, your protocols, that should say what we need to do in each action, each task in the farm. They need to be simple, science-based, and very easy to communicate. Then you have all your processes that go with that, and then an education process, so you can train your people to those standards that you expect them to do. You have your risk assessment, which is, looking at the risk of your farm of breaking with disease, but also auditing your protocols, so understanding if your people are doing what is expected from them. So we're not drifting from the original plan, but we are sticking to that. And lastly, intentionally lastly, the infrastructure. And I'd say lastly because it's like filters, air filters are only good for air. It doesn't substitute good biosecurity program. It won't stop a contaminated truck or contaminated supply or somebody that doesn't follow the rules. So the infrastructure without a solid policy, protocol, education, risk assessment plan is just an expensive cost in your operation, right? So those four components should build a solid biosecurity plan that is always evolving and improving and adapting to the reality of the region, that hopefully can keep that farm healthy.
How often do you evaluate your biosecurity plan?
We use a quarterly approach, and actually have designated a staff person in our management service team that sends out just questionnaires and trying to get feedback on a regular basis. So definitely a monthly call with managers and an email out. I don't know how frequently she's sending those out, but at least every month. And then quarterly assess. Now, with our multiplication, it's every month, every visit. So if we're going to the multiplier as a veterinarian doing herd health work, we're also evaluating all the biosecurity features and reinforcing the training of new people. It's not something to overlook, and that's easy to happen because you have so much else to do that has to do with production. It's not something that you want to overlook. You want to intentionally focus on biosecurity. You had mentioned, and I want to add one more point to your ongoing. We also, through the PED, and the PED is so punishing, and so you don't have to teach why you get rid of PED to your teams, but we created a rapid response team, we call it, which makes it sound cool, I guess. But that group of people are going to go to a farm that's not their farm if that farm breaks with PED, because it's so difficult on the farm staff to go through that and lose all the pigs in the farrowing house. And so that rapid response team, it's a little easier if you know you're only going to be there for a week or two. You're going, and then you go back to your farm. And that's been helpful because that's something you can put together anytime, because you don't have the problem. You're just having the conversation, creating the discussion, having people, I'll do that.
Yeah. If you're in a system or an organization that's big enough to have those resources, I think that's very valuable. But when I think about the individual producer who's out there and he just thinks of his own little kingdom here, and I don't mean little in it, in his own kingdom, he may not have those resources. And yes, PED is devastating, is really hard on the people. I absolutely agree with that. I would go back and challenge both of you just a little bit. Your question was, so how often do you check the biosecurity? Okay? And I'm going to say that if biosecurity is truly going to be a culture, I'm thinking that we check it every day. We make each other accountable. And if you have more than one person in a farm, then we ought to kind of be looking at one another and saying, at the most basic, did you shower in? Did you have contact with pigs yesterday or last night? Did you go to the county fair? Did you step outside to work on the feed bin and not shower back in? How did you, I think we have to make each other accountable. If your culture is going to truly be invasive and be part of the ritual, then it's not a once a week thing. It's not a once a month thing. Yes, you have a veterinarian and they go through and they're looking for certain things. Absolutely, I agree with that. And you have in the PIC system, we will look at truck washes and feed mills on a regular basis. Absolutely. And there's a formal process by which you do that. And we have 1,000-point location scores that we can do once a year, once every 3 years, whenever it's appropriate, and you can follow a schedule. But if you want biosecurity to truly be effective, then it's got to be a 24/7, 365-day-a-year kind of a process. And you need to have that culture so that the guy who raises the door on the chute and he's ready to put his pigs onto or off of a truck, he's got to be able to look at that truck and say, wait a minute, this is not a clean truck. And so, Dr. Hollis, you or me going to a farm on a monthly basis and checking the boxes and making sure that the loading chute is clean, that's all well and good, but there's your decision point, right then and there. And so it's a... You got to have the culture, and it's not it's not always scheduled visits that that will protect you. Fair enough?
Questions for each other? Anything you'd like to ask the other gentlemen around this table? Myself excluded, of course.
John Paul, I have a question for you. We, as a herd veterinarian to some PIC multiplication, we do collect a lot of information and track both successes and failures in biosecurity or in animal handling and these type of things. Have you been able to identify areas that would be of greater risk or processes or things that we do on the farms that are most often the failures or easiest to cheat and they're getting identified? Have you found any of that in the data?
Very, very interesting question, Dr. Beal. I would say that now that we have some, you know, the platform to gather and organize all that information, it's becoming easier to go and organize that and analyze that and try to get insight, you know, decision-making information out of that. And I'll give you an example. We went back and looked for the last 5 years, around 50 farms that had been multipliers at one time, and look at their health records. So did they have a PRRS, PD, Delta, TGE, influenza, Seneca event, mycoplasma outbreak in those 5 years. And then we kind of contrasted that with their risk assessment of what they had, and look at scores and look at specific things and trying to understand what is the value of the risk assessments, but also trying to understand what is the most critical points on those farms and why do they break. So it's given us very good information to fine-tune on the assessments and to fine-tune on the recommendations to those farms and what is important. So that's beginning to yield very good information for us that hopefully will improve the system. I have a question for both of you, doctors, with all your experience. What's next? We're talking about influenza, and I think it's doable. We've done several farms, a couple mass vaccinations, deep up of the nursery, if you have an internal GDU, and you can very consistently eliminate influenza from those farms. After that, what's next? What are we looking at for elimination?
You want to go first?
Go ahead.
All right, so I actually was going to ask a similar question,
that's cheating. No, he asked you first.
but that explains why I kind of have an answer for you right off. Okay, so I think applications to different diseases. We're using similar strategies. For PRRS, mycoplasma, PED, the timelines are all different, but similar strategies for load, close, and standardized immunity. What are the other opportunities that we might have? And I think of diseases like FMD. Now, fortunately, we don't have to do that. But are these applicable? If Jean-Paul, we go to Europe, Can we eliminate FMD with that? What are the tools that we might be able to utilize? And I think of our atrophic rhinitis and also pseudorabies. With Ozjewski's disease, we had a great vaccine that helped a lot. So will we have additional tools, vaccines, for example, that can facilitate our elimination processes? And then lastly, what other diagnostic tools are out there? You know, I think of oral fluids and how that has changed the way we approach diagnostics, particularly in finisher populations. Geez, it's where we used to go out and say, okay, I've got to bleed 60 pigs, now I just hang a few ropes, and it's so much easier. Likewise, in a similar fashion, you know, 2 years ago, it would have been rare, if not, it would at least be rare that anyone would do tracheal samples for mycoplasma. And now it's almost our expectation. If mycoplasma is a question, go out and get some tracheal samples, and psh, we'll know in a matter of days. We don't have to spend a lot of time, and we don't have to kill animals all the time, right? Because the standard used to be, well, let's kill something, let's gather up lungs and tracheas, let's send those in, and then we'll know. Well, we don't necessarily have to sacrifice, especially those highly valued genetic animals. We can do some tracheal samples. But even a year ago, we may not have considered utilizing that. And that skill set, those resources, were not necessarily widespread. Now it is becoming more commonplace. So that's what I see on the horizon, is tools that we have for diagnostics could facilitate our work. Tools that, if we could come up with a traceable differential vaccine for some of these diseases, that would be great. And then applying it to other diseases. I think we've learned some great lessons about timing, for example. From PED, we've learned some very difficult and hard lessons, but I think we're learning now that you get in early, you get in quick, you expose, you don't overexpose, you don't overextend, you don't contaminate the environment more than you have to. And so timing becomes very important. So I see that we fine-tune the strategies and the protocols that we currently have because, yeah, we probably made some mistakes. Your first draft is never as good as the final product. And then develop tools on both sides and then apply these technologies to other pathogens. I think this is fun. And at the risk of sounding crude or coarse, I've had fun the last 20 years eliminating diseases. And it's been an evolution. Makes you a little nervous and anxious sometimes, but
20 years you've been doing this, and we still got them.
I don't have any crystal ball either to say what's next. I think influenza will be different than the others because I think our people can bring it back to the farm, and I think our herds are going to move influenza around. However, learning the shedding period and understanding the population dynamics a little better will give us the opportunity to, at the very least, get it out of the farrowing house and start pigs without coughing. And so if we're not delivering coughing pigs and we're not creating a mixed respiratory disease in the growing population, that's worth the effort. We don't have to designate it as its influenza is gone forever. What we're trying to do is, I think, understand the dynamics of the disease and then make an impact on that disease. My biggest crystal ball for the future would really be implementation. I think we have so many status quo operations that are happy where they're at but don't know where they could be. If we can just get them to stretch and implement some of these disease elimination strategies, production will be better. We're accepting too high of a mortality in almost every segment, and they're better than where they've been in the past, but they're not as good as we could be in terms of sow mortality, baby piglet mortality, nursery and finish mortality.
And these disease elimination successes actually wind up being something of a challenge to our production teams, in that if my herd or my system has PRRS, and I say, well, I've just got to live with it, and my performance is what it is because I have PRRS, then if some veterinarian comes in and convinces the boss that we're going to eliminate PRRS, and you eliminate PRRS, now suddenly you cannot stand behind PRRS and say, that's the reason for my poor production. So disease elimination sometimes takes away excuses for some substandard
I do think we, it's somewhat in the message though as well, so I'm still thinking of my pig dense area with active PRRS that 10 years ago I was the veterinarian saying we have to eliminate, and there was a very strong penalty for re-exposing them to PRRS, mm-hmm. area risk. Mm-hmm. So they eliminated from most but not all, and then broke back every one of those farms. And that, they don't forget that, as they shouldn't.
Yeah.
So I think it's disease control, disease management, it's stack ranking, which ones can we manage, which ones do we need to eliminate.
Do you think it is unrealistic to think that with the right diagnostic tools, at some point we could try some of the endemic bacteria, you know, like the pathogenic Streptococcus suis or specific strains for Haemophilus parasuis, as we have done, for example, Brucella or Mycobacterium without depopulations, right? Just test and removal, and probably some sort of vaccine. So would that be the next frontier that we can develop diagnostics, vaccines, and protocols to try those agents that now are giving us a lot of trouble, and we'll probably have more trouble without the use of antibiotics, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Completely agree with your assessment of Strep suis and Haemophilus parasuis, and those are pig killers also. Even in high health herds, they're going to kill pigs. And so at the very least, they're going to create a high cost of therapy. And so, we need to work on eliminating them, identifying them better, and eliminating them from the population.
One thing we have not specifically said is the interest in the elimination of antibiotics grows, the value of disease elimination becomes more apparent, right? Because if we're trying to cut back on antibiotic usage in the nursery and the finisher, the easiest way to do that is to get rid of PRRS and mycoplasma out of the nursery, right?
In fact, I've had systems tell me you cannot go antibiotic free without PRRS and myco free.
That makes life a whole lot easier, yeah.
I know there's some systems that tried and they would not recommend it.
Joining us on The Squeal today were special guest Dr. Bill Hollis, along with Drs. John Paul Cano and Jer Geiger, discussing disease elimination factors in today's swine herds. You're welcome to share this PIC podcast widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.